Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Trump administration has declared a war on science, but scientists are not taking this lying down. On Earth Day, Saturday, April 22nd, which is next Saturday, scientists and Americans who value the vital importance of scientific principles and research will take to the streets and cities across the country to rally against Trump's war on science. This morning, we talk with two of the organizers for the Portland March for Science, Jackie Wirtz, who is currently the Assistant Dean for Graduate Studies at Oregon Health and Sciences University, and Amanda Thomas, who runs Science on Tap. Amanda and Jackie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hello. Thank you.
And this is probably the most scientists I've had in this room at one time. So why are scientists taking to the streets? We think of scientists in laboratories with white coats, pouring things into beakers and test tubes, and also not communicating that well with the general public. So what has changed and why is this rally this march going to happen?
So one thing to make really clear is that this is a march for science. We are marching because we believe that the principles of the scientific method, logical thinking, use of data to inform policy are really core to making us as Americans fantastic, not only just as our scientific enterprise goes, but as a society. So we are marching proactively and positively to really enforce that message. The stereotype that a scientist is in a white lab jacket, pouring chemicals, socially awkward, may or may not smell bad, that is actually just completely incorrect. Scientists come in all stripes, colors, forms. We do all sorts of crazy, amazing things. Some of us work out of a bench. Some of us go troll the oceans looking for different types of microbes to sequence. The diversity that exists within science and the scientific disciplines that we cover is huge. And we really want to make sure that people highlight that and know that scientists are everyday people as well.
Well, the other thing that I think has been a real concern, starting with, I guess, day one or day two of the Trump administration, when they took all the information about climate change off of the EPA website, and there was a hit list for Department of Energy staff who had attended any kind of climate change conferences. So there's a real chill, which reminds me of what happened under the Stephen Harper government in Canada and up until last year. But there's been a chill on science, and science, along with the fake media in Trump's eyes, is being demonized. But I'm thinking about how we kind of come full circle to a time when I was in second grade, and there was like no interest in science, and then all of a sudden, the Russians launched Sputnik, and there was a big push to have science education, and suddenly, and I loved it because I was really into science as a little kid, and so suddenly we were having these really brand new, wonderful science textbooks and learning about all kinds of stuff, and it was in the middle of the International Geophysical Year, and and there was like this push globally to really highlight science, and science was our heroes, and unfortunately, I think the apex of that was sending a man to the moon, which to me was not maybe the highest level of science, the direction science should go. But we've seen since then, since the late 60s, early 70s, that science has kind of spiraled away from public consciousness to the point now where it's being demonized by our current present administration. Why do you think that's happened?
I think that scientists have possibly done a poor job at communicating what they are all about. Many of them often use a lot of jargon and terminology and formulae and that sort of thing that does not translate well to the general public. And so one of the things that we're trying to do with the march is to humanize scientists and to show that they're regular people and that they're funny and engaging and are just regular people too.
Well, yeah. I'm thinking a lot about all the interviews I've done with scientists over the years. I do. You guys are not the first scientists I've interviewed. And very often I ask them, will you please translate that into English? Because there is a tendency to talk in jargon. Now, that's true of all fields. Social scientists do that. Political activists do that. Yeah. Artists even do that. And radio people. But do you feel like scientists are... I mean, I think that the big place where that became important was with communicating the science of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And because scientists talk in these vague terms and there's probabilities and there's this sense of certainty and uncertainty, and as soon as a general layperson hears uncertainty, he goes, oh, well, I don't believe it. So how is that reshaping the way that scientists are interfacing with the community?
Absolutely. It's really part of how we're trained to think as scientists. I can say isopropyl methylphosphonafluoridate off the top of my tongue, no problem, but I wasn't giving any formal training on how to communicate the global message of my science while I was a graduate student. And this is one thing that we are really investigating as the next generation of science educators, is how to provide communications training for scientists. The scientific climate is changing to the point where scientists can no longer rely on the current grant mechanisms through the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation in order to completely fund their research. So we are having to learn how to communicate the importance and impact of our society, our science, to a slightly different audience, whether that's private foundations or the general public. So right now we're going back and a lot of scientists are getting a lot of education and how to better do that. And we are starting to integrate that into our education of graduate students at Oregon Health and Science University. Now, Amanda works specifically with scientists communicating to lay audiences and can speak a lot to how she has been training them to do this in a really engaging fashion for senior scientists.
Yes, my
Amanda.
Yes, I'll take it away. The series that I run is called Science on Tap, and it's an opportunity for scientists to engage with the general public, and we hold them in theaters where there are adult beverages served, and so it's an informal setting, and so I encourage our speakers to feel like they're going to have a microphone in one hand and a beer in the other. And so that's the level of discourse that they should talk about. So they're not, I don't want them to dumb it down, in quotes, but I want them to assume that the audience is smart, but they haven't learned specifically what that speaker's area of expertise is. And so they need to be able to communicate those in simpler terms. You can still communicate complicated problems or complicated situations, but if you use more simplified terms, it's easier for the general person to understand.
Well, one of the thoughts I have about the difficulty that scientists have in communicating has to do with in training, but scientists are trained to think in terms of formulas and equations. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, like I kind of got up to about calculus and my eyes glazed over and that was it. And I stopped and I wasn't going to be a scientist anymore.
Yeah.
But then like in my 20s, I got very interested again in reading science and I'd read all these books. But every time I came to a formula, mm-hmm. I would just skip it. Mm-hmm. And I later on, when I started doing this radio show, I sort of got myself, my math isn't very strong, but I got myself to try to at least figure out what some of these formulas might mm-hmm. mean. But the formulas, scientists think in formulas the same way like musicians think in music and notation. And my question is, how do you translate what you think and express in a formula into English that is just as graphic? Because mm-hmm. I understand that formulas are like poetry. I mean, mm-hmm. they are a very precise way of explaining things. Mm-hmm. So is there a way that you can get that same precision and power, but do it in words?
Yeah, I teach biochemistry, and I always tell people that biochemistry is kind of like speaking another language. Once you learn the terms and learn how to use the language itself, you can be really quite eloquent and fluent in it. But conversely, that also means that you have to translate biochemistry into English on occasion. The ability to synthesize information, explain its impact, and to do so elegantly, simplistically, and also being true to the complexity of the underlying science is a true skill and is something that is completely doable. We have luminaries that we all can name, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, Brian Druker, all of these people can do that, and it just takes practice. One thing that's important about science is that we do this because we love the science. We love learning and we love the topic that we're deeply investigating. Part of that investigation includes understanding the bigger impact of the work that we're doing. So scientists are receiving and generating and developing that contextual information to help frame their communications back out. We just need to give them a couple more platforms to really develop the skills to communicate them out.
I've been lucky enough to work with a number of scientists who are very good at communicating their scientific concepts in a human way. One I can think of specifically, Christine McKinley is a mechanical engineer, and she wrote a book called Physics for Rock Stars. So physics seems like it's a very intimidating field and not very understandable to your average person, but she used examples that were, if you were a rock star and you wanted to jump off your stage to do some crowd surfing, what kind of force and that sort of thing would you need? So she's using perhaps maybe not real life examples, but at least at least examples that somebody could get involved in and engaged in and use those examples as a way to teach physics concepts. So I think that using creative analogies and stories is a great way for scientists to communicate what their message is.
And it's also important to remember that not all science is going to be statistically based or mathematically based. One of our speakers at the rally is Rich Hatfield, and he's going to be talking about conservation biology, specifically bee populations. This involves a lot of field work, going out on hikes, and just observing the nature of the world around us. So science really does come in all shapes and forms, and sometimes they're more qualitative, sometimes they're more quantitative.
Well, I was thinking about one of the great scientists of all times and his ability to communicate to the general public was Albert Einstein.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who I read this really wonderful biography a few months ago, and which had some formulas in it. It was mm-hmm. interesting. And I thought that this author did a pretty good job in explaining in lay terms what Einstein's ideas are about. Mm-hmm. And not always, but pretty good. And I was really reminded as I was reading the biography of just how Einstein was this amazing, very fully live person, and he was an incredible ethicist and philosopher mm-hmm. and humanitarian mm-hmm. and he got politically engaged, and he just did a lot of other things besides being a scientist.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he could be like put up as the role model for what this is what a scientist, not just be brilliant and be able to come up with the theory of relativity when you're 26, mm-hmm. but to be able to represent to the world the best compassion, the best traits of a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. He is an exemplar when it comes to the marriage of scientific passion being able to be applied into areas like political activism and just being a champion for humanism and science generally. Even more locally, Linus Pauling, one of our preeminent two-time Nobel Prize winning scientists of Oregon heritage, was one who really felt that the nuclear war weaponry was going to be a serious ethical issue, and he won his second Nobel Prize trying to combat that on a political platform.
It was a peace prize.
Yeah. And this is speaking to the longevity of science actually speaking up for science. We are marching for science informed policy. We're not marching against politicians, but scientists should really feel like this is a time for us to be empowered to really call out to our political representatives the fact that science is important, science drives policy, and that we can play a role in this.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with two of the organizers for this Saturday's March for Science, which is going to start at Tomacall Park.
Yes.
And actually, it's going to be the same route as the Women's March.
Yes.
Are you expecting as many people?
We would love as many people. That was such a phenomenal thing.
I saw 20,000 is your goal, which would be a fifth of what the Women's
right,
March was.
Right, yeah.
By the way, I want you know, you're listening today. My guests are Amanda Thomas, who runs Science on Tap, which is a way of bringing scientists and the general population together mm-hmm. in pubs, and Jackie Wirtz, who teaches her students up at OHSU how to communicate their science to, again, the mm-hmm. general public. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this march. And mm-hmm. I saw this wonderful article in the Oregonian, actually really surprised me. And these scientists are out there in Moynihan Park measuring things and, like, you know, doing the equation of this and that, scouting out the thing. And I thought, and they had these expressions. Because I think there are scientists like Linus Pauling and many others I remember who were longtime activists. But for a lot of scientists, this is probably a new adventure.
Absolutely. The Oregonian, as they interviewed us, they asked us, like, is this the first time you've been politically involved in this way? And for a majority of us on the steering committee, this is our first foray into taking our passion for science into a more political realm. And again, this does come with a lot of worry, because this is not a role that traditionally a majority of scientists have engaged in. And there's a lot of editorials out there about why perhaps this is maybe not the best step for scientists. However, again, I really believe that here, particularly in Portland, Oregon, we're putting a positive spin on this, and we're really making sure that this is support of science. And that is something that I believe all scientists can get behind. We are asking for support for logic and data-driven policy.
Well, actually, I mean, it's kind of like what the whole argument, the biggest argument that's been going on since January 20th, mm-hmm. and probably going back to November 8th, which is there anything is there truth anymore? I mean, like there was the Time magazine cover a few weeks ago, is truth dead? But that we have a certain force in this country which believes that they can say anything they want that comes from a total emotional base, that it has an ideological bent on it, mm-hmm. To twist the facts to serve your ideology. Mm-hmm. And that is the basic method of dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about what happened in Turkey over this weekend, where they've just enshrined another dictator, mm-hmm. And given him full power. And it's a very scary place to be on. And it really looked like when Trump took office that the United States was really heading in this place too. Mm-hmm. However, what I appreciated and I started learning more about as the weeks unfolded is this: a lot of scientists were being preemptive, like trying to save as much data as possible, mm-hmm. from right. government servers. And that being a scientist has become a revolutionary act. Mm-hmm. But what it seems to me it's really about is trying to keep a level of intellectual honesty on mm-hmm. all fronts. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I want to talk about the hits that you started feeling as soon as Trump was basically elected or selected, mm-hmm. or whatever, and your response to that and how that is built up to the point where scientists feel like they have to march in the streets.
Well, there's so much I'm thinking of. It's hard to know. I think that a lot of scientists were feeling very insecure about their funding. I mean, that's continuing to go on because there are so many.
So are the rest of us, actually.
Yeah,
radio stations.
And yeah, exactly. And so, like you said, the scientists are doing things like backing up their data and trying to get the word out in other ways and looking for other sources of funding. And one thing I want to point out is that we are not talking about just scientists here. What we're trying to do is engage people who aren't scientists. So, for example, Jackie is a PhD scientist, and I'm not. I'm not a scientist. I have been doing science education for 10 years or more, and our steering committee is made up of people who are both actual scientists with degrees, and they work in the field and the bench and whatnot, and also people who are just regular people who believe that science is important. And we hope that throughout all of this attack on funding and attack on science in general, that regular people will understand the important role that science plays in their lives. So the iPhones that are in their pockets, or the fact that people are listening to this over a radio is science. And I think that is something that is becoming more clear, is that the role that play, or I hope it's becoming more clear that the role that science plays in everybody's personal everyday lives is becoming much more clear and much more apparent. And so we are inviting people who aren't scientists, but who are affected by science, who is frankly everybody, to join us in this. And I think that more regular people, non-scientists, are beginning to realize how important it is.
Well, actually, I think science is playing a more crucial role right now in saving the planet than it ever has. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thinking back to Einstein's time, actually, science played a pretty pivotal role in almost destroying the planet, which is one of the things that Einstein recognized really early on. Mm-hmm. But now, with climate change right at the forefront, and having an administration, it was this kind of breath of fresh air to have the Obama administration actually mm-hmm. acknowledging climate change was a very serious problem. And that I think about all the research that was done in the last 8 years and the amazing array of data that was available on all the government websites. And that's all over now. And we have head of the EPA who wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement and who believes the climate change is a hoax. How do scientists stand up to those kind of pressures? Because it seems that the scientists need to be listened to more than ever now, and mm-hmm. also need to communicate in a stronger way than ever, that how much in peril the planet really is.
I think it's really important that we get away from this idea that scientists are working in isolation and that they are producing these things and this science speaks for itself. One of the things that is my least favorite phrases is that the data speaks for itself. If the data spoke for itself, all scientists would be out of a job. It is our role and responsibility to speak for that data, to speak for the science that we're developing. And I think that the number one thing that we can do as the administration has changed its priorities is to make sure that we are being effective voices for that data. data. Now, it's happened in the past that we've been able to be effective voices for things like climate change data and climate change research, as well as public available of all data produced by the National Institutes of Health, that we haven't had to really make it a broad communication base outside of our immediate scientific collaborators and peers. Now the audience has changed. The priorities have changed. We still need to do excellent, high quality work, but we're just going to have to do a much better job communicating it to the broader audience. The only way that we're going to be able to change administration's ideas on the priorities and values of science is if we engage in a dialogue. And the hardest part of that is not only communicating the quality of our science, but listening and being able to come up with ideas and a discussion that helps engage people that don't necessarily believe in science to better understand how we can help sway them and really enlighten people about the quality and the importance of the science that we're doing.
But it seems to me that with this administration, that they have an ideology that's based on being against science and debunking science. So it seems like that not only do you have to communicate the science better, but we have to organize politically.
Yes, and I think that's something that we've been seeing is that more and more scientists or people who are positive science advocates are getting more involved. So the people who are involved in organizing the march, the people who hopefully come out for the march, and also people who are running for office now and trying to take a more active role in the political process are really important allies in this.
Actually, I keep getting an email from somebody, Shaughnessy. She ran for office in Pennsylvania. I don't think she came anywhere close to winning it, but she's a scientist who's running for office. Mm-hmm. And this, her agent is promoting her on radio shows. Uh-huh. But I thought it was interesting. I mean, I'm wondering how many scientists are running for office now.
I don't know that number. It's more than it was, but...
Yeah, I don't know that number either. It's interesting. I went to the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is one of our largest and oldest scientific organizations in the United States. And there were sessions on how to become more politically involved and how to get your stuff together to consider running for office. So this is a new, relatively new thing to be addressed at that level. Prior to January, we actually had... there was an article written up by the American Association for the Advancement of Science about how a similar activity at a large conference had very few participants, but after January, the same activities had a much broader participation base. So I think scientists are knowing that this is something that's going to be something that is part of practicing science. Now, that's not to say that all scientists agree. There's been a lot of commentary and a lot of discussion by scientists that don't feel that it is right or appropriate for them to engage in the political arena. And again, that is something that, you know, it's their personal beliefs not to do so. I support their belief in what they want to do and how they want to execute their scientists. But personally, as a scientist who fights for education and who fights for increasing our general understanding of the world around us, I believe that it is my responsibility as a responsible scientist and a responsible educator to make sure that I am articulating this to the new administration and to the world broadly.
Well, I think also scientists have kind of had a mixed history throughout history. And well, there was Lavoisier, who had made brilliant some chemical discoveries and was collecting
and
taxes.
And his wife.
who wouldn't get any credit.
Right, yeah.
But, and then he was also collecting taxes for Louis the 16th,
right.
And was a target of the French Revolution. So it was an early example of a political a catastrophe for a scientist. But what comes to my mind in terms of like the scientists fall on all sides of the political spectrum. So
absolutely.
On the one hand, there's Albert Einstein. On the other hand, there's Edward Teller and Herman Kahn. And for people who don't know who they are, Edward Teller proudly argues that he was the father of the hydrogen bomb. Mm-hmm. Though I think that there's other people who want that honor, and that's sort of said to me a lot about who he is. He brags about that. And then Herman Kahn wrote a book about how we can live with thermonuclear war.
Well, so this just goes to the question of humanizing science. So scientists are of all stripes personally as well. So one of the questions early on that I got quite frequently was, are Republicans allowed to march in the March for Science? I said, absolutely. You can be a scientist or a science supporter and be a Republican. You can be a scientist or a science supporter who is religious. You can be a scientist or a science supporter who has some crazy ideals out there. Just because you believe in science doesn't mean that you are going to be classified as this one thing and you cannot be anything else.
Actually, I'm having memories now of all these different scientists I've dealt with that kind of gave me problems. I interviewed a guy at at Battelle Labs up at Hanford many years ago, who was basically promoting that Hanford was safe and they should make more repositories for nuclear waste and they should build the N reactor and all the things that they were talking about in the late 70s, early 80s. And I question him about something, and I'm like, how do you know that this nuclear waste you're putting in the ground is not going to migrate to the Columbia River and be danger to humanity and to nature for millions of years? And he said, we know because we're scientists and we know the truth. And I looked at him, and he had a picture of Jesus, and below the picture of Jesus was Ronald Reagan. And I thought, okay, and so that's a scientist. And then I also read a statistic about the number of engineers, basically computer engineers, who believed in creationism and did not believe in evolution. And they're scientists, and they know what they know. And so therefore, you know, because they're scientists, they know that evolution is not real. So there are scientists, a very small percentage of them, who claim that climate change is a hoax. I'm not sure what their scientific credentials are, and I don't think any of them are actually climate scientists. But there is this move within certain facets of scientists or people who claim to be scientists where they claim to know the truth, and the truth would be kind of shocking to somebody who had actually done the studies and analyzed the data.
Right. And I think that, well, I know that one of the things we were just in our steering committee meeting yesterday, we were talking about how we want to try and teach people how to think. Critically. Sorry. Teaching people how to think critically will help them figure out or help them be able to discern better what kinds of studies are realistic or not. So the scientists that you were talking about who claim that climate change isn't real, then if there's only one of them in a room of 100 scientists, there's somebody on the other side. But if somebody, a regular layperson, understands what thinking critically looks like and can look at that and see, okay, well, the preponderance of the evidence, the data is on one side, and there's just this one person over here, then clearly they can judge better for themselves what is actually about science. One of the things that I've been trying to do with my events is encourage people to think skeptically about things. And I've said in the past that if I can convince somebody who reads an article and says, okay, the way to make your hair shinier is to eat bacon and pineapple, and only that. And so they want to do that. But if they look at the study and say, okay, well, let's think critically about this. How many people were in the study? Who did the study? Was it a double-blind study? You know, what do those things mean? Anybody can claim anything, but if they're, as we were just talking about, but if we have a framework within which people can judge whether or not that data is valuable, then we will have people making better decisions.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the upcoming March for Science, which is going to be this Saturday, starting at Tom McCall Park and marching around downtown Portland. I guess the march starts at 11:30.
The march starts at 11. It's a three-part event. We have a rally at 10 o'clock where we have a bunch of fantastic speakers that will be discussing science, society, and what we can do to make sure that the support for logic-driven decisions is put forth locally as well as nationally.
This is not going to school, so we're going to have the lecture first.
Yeah. Oh, this is active learning, though. This is truly active learning. And then
we have recess. We go for a march.
There we go for the march. And then during the march, the expo area on Tom McCall Waterfront Park will actually have a science expo. We'll have more than 30 different booths where you can interact, ask a scientist questions, learn more about brains. You can actually hold a brain and all sorts of fun things, as well as live music.
And so I just want to let you know that was Jackie Wirtz, who's with OHSU, teaching scientists to be how to communicate with the rest of us. And we're also talking this morning with Amanda Thomas, who runs a program called Science on Tap. Well, I want to wind up today talking more about what's going to be actually happening in the march. But before that, I still want to kind of throw out some of the challenges that people have, including, I think, people who really care about humanity and care about the world and nature, about their concerns about the way the science is used. And so I was thinking of some more evil uses of science. And I mean, the ultimate one is the Nazis. And those were a lot of scientists were involved with really horrendous experiments and procedures and all kinds of horrible plans and visions under the Nazis. A lot of those scientists then came to the United States and ran our nuclear weapons program, Wernher von Braun being the most famous of them. And then there have been, I mean, some of the scientific discoveries, I forget the name of the guy who discovered fertilizer. But it was as nerve gas.
Zyklon B.
Right. That guy who actually, I mean, and that which was used to kill mm-hmm. people in the concentration camps, or as Sean Spicer would call them, the Holocaust centers Nazi Germany. not a good joke. But that guy actually really regretted his invention, as did Nobel for inventing the dynamite, which is why he came up with that prize for peace. Mm-hmm. I think that this sometimes really dissuades people from trusting science because they see all the evil uses that science mm-hmm. can be. And then I know friends of mine who are real involved with fighting for GMOs to be labeled. And there's mm-hmm. a lot of scientists, and including the National Association of Advancement for Science, mm-hmm. which has come out very strongly in support of GMO and against GMO labeling, and identifies GMO opponents being the same as climate deniers. Mm-hmm. So there's ways in which people who I think have very enlightened feelings about science actually mm-hmm. are kind of a little disturbed by the way that some scientists react to them.
Exactly. So I think a lot of this problem with science being co-opted and used in negative fashions, and science that may be running in deep channels that are retrospectively quite harmful overall, I think that one of the ways that we're bypassing that in the modern 21st century is the interdisciplinary nature of science. It's really increasingly difficult to do science in a silo and in a vacuum by yourself. We are, as a scientific community, continuing to come together in new and innovative ways to really progress science. And that means that you're going to be collaborating with people across different disciplines. And that provides additional checks and balances to make sure that you're proceeding in an ethical, a productive manner. So I really believe that the future of science is in this interdisciplinary area, which will help provide some securities against those atrocities of science. Another thing is that the silos within science are how you get people that are lumping pro-GMO being anti this or anti that being anti that. And I think that, as we are looking at the complexity of the world around us, it is really difficult to try and bin people in those types of categories. And inevitably, people are going to make mistakes doing so. Interdisciplinary development of more conversations between scientists and humanists, between scientists and philosophers, and between scientists and just the general public is going to help create a stronger sense of trust. And I think that is one of the major outcomes that I'm looking for from the March for Science, both here and in the 500 marches across the world, is creating dialogue, creating a lot of conversation so that we will have a better sense of trust and communication with the community.
Now, another issue you brought up earlier was about funding. And that's one of the things that's driving scientists into the streets. I have this image right now, Oregon State University and the School of Forestry. Mm-hmm. There's two buildings and they're connected by a sky bridge.
Yeah.
The traditional building is clear cut and plant mm-hmm. and use lots of pesticides and, mm-hmm. and fertilizer. The other building is sustainable ag, mm-hmm. I mean, sustainable forestry, where you are like understanding ecosystems, and that's where the whole forest protection plan was developed, and a lot of the studies about spotted owl and the whole, I mean, just a real ecological basis and, mm-hmm. of approaching forestry. And I've just had that image in my mind ever since I went and interviewed people on either side of that sky bridge, seeing how far apart those two worlds are.
Yeah.
And the side that gets, that's the chemical forestry, gets all the funding mm-hmm. because that's all private funding. And the side that is ecological forestry is always scrambling for money. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with that? Because that's one of the things when you talk about there's less government funding, though mm-hmm. a lot of the government funding went to the chemical side mm-hmm. all along. But if most of the funding is going to be coming from private foundations and private corporations, how are we going to be able to maintain a scientific balance where we are continuing to look in a rational and critical way as opposed to looking in the direction where the money is?
I think that we need to diversify our idea of what can fund science. I really believe that people are going to galvanize together and donate to causes that they think are worth their time, energy, and money. And those new types of topically oriented foundations are going to be key to the survival of some of our basic sciences in the future.
But do they have enough money?
Not right now.
I mean, it's like the Bullitt Foundation is a great foundation, yeah, but they're just a pretty small foundation
right
still.
And I think that that's part of what we're hoping to help achieve with the march, is to get the word out more, to become more visible to the general public about what kind of things scientists are going through right now, and how it will affect everybody and everyday people. And so just by raising the profile of scientists and science research in general, hopefully we can help get people together and have them talk to their legislators or donate to funds or that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was thinking about all the groups that are being targeted by the Trump administration. And of course, the first one we think about is immigrants, and in particular, immigrants from Middle Eastern countries, mm-hmm, or majority Islamic countries, and immigrants from Latin America. Mm-hmm. And somewhere down the line are scientists and people. I mean, because and this reminds me more of McCarthyism, mm-hmm, than it does of Nazism, let's say. Though the Nazis took all the money away from the Jews. You know, so actually, when you want to target somebody, you make sure that they can't earn a living. But it seems like that is a real fear for a lot of scientists, that they're losing their funding, they're not going to be able to do their work, and they're going to wind up working at McDonald's.
Yes, this is a legitimate fear. At Oregon Health and Science University, a huge percentage of our funding comes from the National Institutes of Health. There's been a $5.8 billion suggested cut in that budget, which works out to be 18%. This not just injures our ability to perform our work, it also, it completely derails it. It's not just a 20% cut in our productivity. It is a fundamental dismantling of our ability to produce cutting-edge scientists. Now, the solution to this has been the fact that science is actually something that does generate bipartisan support, and the budget that President Trump has proposed still has to go through Congress. And Congress is wanting to make sure that we will have tools necessary to survive. So I really believe that this is the time to let our congressional representatives and our senates know that this is a priority, and that they have the power in the appropriations committees to really rescue some of these budget items.
And I want to also mention, if OHSU is going to have an 18% budget cut, then that also affects jobs. So even if you aren't necessarily pro-science or that sort of thing, science creates jobs, and funding for science creates jobs. And so that is important. Oregon, I don't know what the numbers are, but Oregon gets a lot of our jobs and our income for the state from scientists.
I think I have it in my pack here.
Oh.
our top five employers in the state of Oregon are all STEM-based: Intel, OHSU, Providence, Kaiser, all of them. And that is thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs.
And just to be clear, STEM means science, technology, engineering, and math.
Thanks for catching me on my jargon.
Yeah, no worries.
Well, let's just wind up with talking a bit more details about this march, what people can expect, mm-hmm, and the kind of the lay of the land. What should you bring, and mm-hmm, where are you going to go?
Well, it starts, as Jackie was mentioning, it starts at Tom McCall Waterfront Park at 10 a.m. We're going to have a rally and some talks, short talks, by a number of fantastic people. And are we announcing who those people are?
Yes, we are. We are going to be kicking off. Well, first of all, Amanda Thomas is going to be our MC, so I'm really excited about that.
Yay.
Our very first speaker is going to be Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, who's a medical doctor at Oregon Health and Science University and director of the Breast Center at the Knight Cancer Institute, as well as being one of our elective representatives in the Oregon state government. And she's going to be talking about why science is important and what caused her to run for office as a scientist. Next, we have Rich Hatfield, a conservation biologist and petitioner for the listing of the rusty patch bumblebee under the ESA. And he, in addition to being a steering committee member, has a lot of experience with community-based conservation biology activism and work. So he's going to be talking about the importance of protecting the Endangered Species Act, as well as why he's marching today. After that, we have Shashi Jain, who is an Intel entrepreneur, and he'll be addressing young people specifically and telling them how life-changing science can be. And we're going to follow him up with Gabe Shuships, who is a fish biologist at Walla Walla and a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. Then we have our two closing speakers are going to be Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, as well as Congressman Earl Blumenauer, both of whom are very active for the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics STEM agenda at DC. And we'll be talking about the importance of science, the importance of activism, and then how particularly women in STEM can be promoted through the state of Oregon.
I guess I actually wanted to add, we've got one more week of resistance recess, and it's a time where people can go to the town halls and offices and sidewalks and driveways of their elected officials and let them know what we think. And I just want to put a shout out to all of our listeners in Hood River and in basically in Greg Walden's district. You're the ones who can reach Greg Walden. Those of us who live in Bonamici's district and Earl Blumenauer's district and even Kurt Schrader, we don't, and I guess we might have some listeners down in the second district as well. But for those of you who live in Greg Walden's district, you're the ones he's going to listen to. And I understand he's had some really rowdy town halls, or at least one in Hood River. Keep up the work, because I think he's one of those Congress people who will get to understand that he is not on the same page as his constituents, and that we're concerned about the things we're talking about today, and these concerns about science translate into all aspects of life that are under a threat right now.
Right. So the rally will go from 10 to 11, and then at 11 o'clock, we're going to start the march going south down NATO Parkway and around, and as you mentioned, the same pathway that the Women's March took, and then end up back at Tom McCall Waterfront Park, where we will have the Science Expo, which, as Jackie mentioned earlier, will have 30 or more different groups who will be doing all sorts of demos and fun things, like having human brains out that you can pick up and look at, and we're going to have some live spiders in cages, but a spider expert talking about that and how to make a hologram and other kinds of chemical explosions and things like that. So it's going to be fun for the whole family. There will be a kid zone as well, where there's going to be a lot of science-related activities for small children. And we will have several bands on stage throughout the afternoon. And so we're hoping for a big festival-like experience.
And it won't rain.
Right.
Actually, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us, and I'm looking forward to the march. I'll see you there.
Great.
And thanks for letting us know. We've been talking this morning with Amanda Thomas and Jackie Wirtz, who are on the steering committee for the Portland March for Science. And you've been listening to Late Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about how urban biodiversity is not an oxymoron with frequent Locus Focus guest Mike Houck and his accomplices David Maddox, who's founder and director of the Nature of Cities program in New York City, and Chantal Van Ham from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in Brussels. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Farron. Thanks for listening.
They said some men would be warriors and some men would be kings.